In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with novelist Catherine Vaz. She is Associate Professor of English at University of California, Davis, and at the moment is a Briggs Copeland Lecturer in Creative Writing at Harvard University. She's authored two novels, a critically acclaimed collection of short stories. Her second novel is Mariana, and that's what we'll be talking about here this morning on the program. It has been printed in six languages and has been well received around Europe. It was first published in Britain in 1997 and just recently has now been published in the United States. It's published by Oliform Publishing. And the book tells the story of a young noblewoman. Actually, it tells the story of her entire life. A young woman named Mariana Alcoforado, who as a teenager goes into a convent. And this is in the 17th century, during the time when there is a struggle going on in Portugal, her home country, for independence. And the Portuguese have allied with the French against the Spanish. In spite of the fact that she is in a convent and she is a nun, she has a passionate affair with a French mercenary who eventually leaves. She writes a series of love letters to him that end up being published first in France and then elsewhere and become something of a sensation around Europe. That is a thumbnail sketch of the story. We can flesh it out a little bit more as we talk with the author, Catherine Vaz. This novel was selected by the U.S. Library of Congress as one of the top 30 international books of 1998. Her collection, Fado and Other Stories, won the Drew Heinz Literature Prize in 1997. She's published in a number of literary quarterlies and has received other awards for her work. She was here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about writing last week, and unfortunately our schedule didn't allow us to have her on the program while she was here, but we thought that we'd still like to take the opportunity to talk with her. And so she is at Harvard and we are here, but we're pleased that she could talk with us. And as we talk, of course, if there are people who have questions, you're welcome to call 333-9455. And toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, Catherine Vaz, good morning. Thanks for talking with us.
Good morning, David. I'm happy to be here in this sound booth in Harvard. I did enjoy my visit very much to the University of Illinois. It was actually my first trip to the state, so it was very nice.
Well, I'm glad you could join us this way. I'm sorry we couldn't do it in person, but this is, I guess, second best, having a connection like this. As some people will hear the way that you sound, and maybe we'll think that you're actually here sitting beside me, and she's not. She's in Harvard. Let's start by talking about the letters, because I think that's where, for you, the novel began, and particularly because, as I understand it, there are some people who question whether, in fact, well, who it is who wrote them, whether Mariana
right.
Alcoforado actually wrote them. I think there are some people who even ask whether she actually existed or not. Is there good evidence in the fact that, at the very least, that there was there was such a person?
There is evidence, but with a lot of things that have to do with research, it really is what school of thought you want to follow. And, in fact, most of the things written about this particular nun, who is considered a great romantic icon, mostly in Europe, there's the school of thought that they were written by a Frenchman. They were contraband in Portugal for the first 100 years after the time of her life. And there are a lot of Portuguese scholars who've put together evidence to suggest there was a noblewoman, really from the richest family in the province, who did live at that time, was severely punished at one point of her life. And there's a lot of evidence. Probably the chief bit of research is that it actually was a French abbot who found a first edition in his library maybe about 20, 30 years after her death in the early 18th century. And her name was written in the margin, and the name of Noble Tong, who was perhaps her lover, and he is the one who actually started the research. I will say that in order to believe the Portuguese side of the story, you have to read the Portuguese sources, and academics are much more likely to read the French sources, which might take another tact. For me as a novelist, I didn't want to get involved in the squabble of did she live or not, who's the real author. I've read portions of the letters to people who say, oh, absolutely, a woman wrote this. There's no way a man wrote these. And in fact, the letters were such a huge success in France when they were first published that the the publisher at the time decided to come out with a new edition that he commissioned, and they bombed. So there's a question of authenticity just from the voice. But for me as a novelist, I just didn't want to get involved in that academic squabble. I wanted to say, well, if this is a real romantic icon, can I not construct a life based on the Portuguese sources' history in her life? And I went back to the convent, read in the massive libraries of the curator there, and constructed the story of a woman. I will say also that the poet Rilke is really the person, despite the fact that I have a Portuguese-American background, Rilke's the one who's translated the letters into German in his lifetime, made her very popular in Germany, and he had no problem believing she was a real person, and that, in fact, whether she was real or not, the spirit of the letters and who she was suggested someone of great passion and depth to him. And Matisse did representations of her. Modigliani, Rodin used to talk about the awe she inspired, and Stendhal wrote about her. So I really wanted to introduce her as a character to an American audience, and not so much as a novelist say, gee, I want to do the academic thing and put my marker down at whether she's real or not. Mm. So that's where I came from with how I approach telling a story about her.
Well, in one interview that I read where you're discussing talking about her and talking about the novel, you say that in Portugal, Mariana is a cultural heroine of the highest order. What sort of significance does she have to the Portuguese?
Well, she's considered in some ways to embody that great, passionate, independent, strong spirit of women. I'll give you a kind of funny example. I was walking along the wharf in Lisbon after my visit to Beja, which is where the convent is, or the remains of the convent are, I should say. And I came across this book stall that just happened to have a first edition watercolor version of the letters from the 19th century. And I pointed at it and said that I wanted to look at it and that I was perhaps going to do a book to tell her story to Americans. And he was so flabbergasted that Americans hadn't heard of this great romantic passionate figure that he wanted to give me this very valuable book for free. And just out of guilt, I had to pay him something. But he just was like, it was like this Portuguese man saying, I can't believe everyone isn't just mad about her, so please just take it and do what you can with it. The irony is the book was a bestseller in Portugal after I wrote it. And some of my friends in Portugal said, well, why did you have to explain so much about what the Alentejo looks like and the circumstances of the convent and so on, because we all know about that. And I said, well, I didn't write it for you. I wrote it for Americans, really. So the book has had a really interesting circuit in the world, one I really didn't expect. One thing I can add about nuns that people and Americans may not really completely realize is that these were not nuns in the sense that nowadays we in America think of nuns. These were young girls who were either given back to God and put in the convent from a very young age, or they were, frankly, parents in the aristocracy did not want to divide their landholdings among too many sons-in-law, so they put the girls in the convents. And this particular one was the richest in the whole country at the time, even though it's now in a kind of a more subdued agricultural area, but it's very lavish. And these women had what amounted to studio apartments they were allowed to wear their own clothes. They had servants, running around. This was until the king cracked down and said, that's enough. And so affairs in the convent were not that outrageous. They were punished and they were frowned upon, but it was a little more loose than we think of it. These were not necessarily girls who had vocations, although some of them did. So there is that distinction to be made. And the irony I found was that a lot of these nuns had more independence as women than a lot of their married sisters.
Hmm. Why did it take so long for this to be published in the United States?
Oh, I don't know. I actually really liked her as a character. She's very willful. I thought she was a wonderful character to work with, and I just figured she would do things in the time she needed to do them. Mm. I sold the movie rights here in the United States before I even sold the book, and not much has happened with that, but I just took the attitude that it was a surprise what happened. Anyway, the book was well received in Italy for the very funny reason that I had a number of interviews, mostly with women who were Italian journalists. And they said that they all grew up with a similar nun, you know, what they called their naughty nun, who was the nun of Monza. And they said, oh, you know, she always felt so guilty and full of sin and spent the rest of her life lamenting. And we had to read all about that. And she said, we loved your book because Mariana never feels any apology or regret. And they all really loved that. So I thought that was very funny. I don't know why it didn't get published here, but now it is here. And Aliform is a publishing house that specializes in lots of Latin American books and books from the Iberian Peninsula. So it's a nice home for it. I guess it was just a matter of it finding its nice home. You know, she's waited a couple hundred years as it is, so I figured one or two more aren't going to matter too much.
Yeah. Well, the book that we're talking about is titled Mariana, by our guest Catherine Vaz, V-A-Z, the spelling of her last name. And Aliform is indeed the publisher. It's now available in paperback here in the United States, so you might go out and look for it. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. She is a wonderful character. When we first meet her, she is, I think, only 11 and is very strong-willed, very much has a sense that she knows what she wants, is a bright girl, very, very strong heroine. So I certainly would expect that a lot of women would like her very much.
I hope so, but I hope men like her also. I had a very good male friend who said that he just fell in love with her and wept at certain parts of the book, which was a strong admission for him. She is really strong-willed, and I will tell you that she was so strong-willed that this sounds like one of those sort of Californian dream stories, but I promise you it's really true. A couple days after I finished the book, I was quite exhausted, and I was living in California at the time, and I had a dream that this nun was walking up our brick pathway carrying a stack of papers. And I remember thinking in the dream, turn around so I can see your face and see if I got it right, which she never did. And I thought, well, she's stubborn even in my dreams. But I thought, oh, she's so willful. She's actually saying, I know you're tired, but get the thing out of the house. Mm-hmm. So I actually got up and sent it out. And it had a strange route. I sent it to an agent in New York who, without telling me, passed it along to a fellow named Patrick Walsh in London at the Christopher Little Agency, and got a call from him out of the blue from London saying that the London Book Fair was coming up and he wanted to show it around. And so I thought, if she hadn't had that dream with me getting out of the house, I would have missed the London Book Fair. So I thought, she's so willful and interesting as a character that she's kind of inhabited a part of me. I never have quite seen her face. And the interesting thing about the cover is that I very much like the painting of the woman looking out, and I thought, oh, that looks like it could be her face. I did want to add one thing, that the book is not, as far as I know, available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but it is through the Aliform website, which is Aliform Group, I think, .com or .org, so it's Aliform Group. He's got his own website that's selling the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, the picture on the front, there's a woman who is looking out a window, a young woman, and she's resting her face on one hand and looking out sort of, I guess, forlornly, you'd have to say, looking out of the window. So no one knows, if indeed this woman existed, no one knows what it is that she looked like.
No. I mean, there wouldn't have been any representations of her. In fact, one of the problems of verifying this is because it was the habit of burying nuns without grave markers. That was maybe an abbess would get one, but it was considered that you had given yourself back to God, and so none of the nuns had marked gravestones, but they were buried under the walkways in the cloister. So that's a problem of verification that just exists historically.
Do you have a copy of the book with you?
I do have it in front of me, yeah.
Okay. Well, Ed, since we have such a good connection, I'm sure that people would like to maybe hear a little bit of something from the book,
right,
so they can get a feeling for the writing and for you. And maybe there's something that you, I don't know if there's something particular like you would like to read, but I'm thinking maybe something from the earlier section where we see her when she is young before she goes into the convent.
Well, I can start out the first page. I also have a section that's quite brief that describes her meditation on the color orange later on, which is based on some of that. And I also, depending on how much time I have, I can read the first letter. Takes about 5 to 8 minutes to read. So whatever you'd like me to do.
Okay. Well, we should have plenty of time to do maybe all of that.
Okay.
Just give us a little taste here to start out with.
All right. Well, why don't I start from the opening then and just read a brief passage there. When Mariana was too restless, she counted angels. Her father taught her that all the children in Portugal were learning to do this. "These are dangerous times," Papa warned. "The angels will watch over you during the hours when I cannot. You worry about the next world and leave this one to me." When her father was away, Mariana counted the hours, which were round on the color of air, like invisible clocks. When they looked unbearably faceless, she pretended she could string them together into necklaces made of sky. Sometimes Mariana would shout, "Speak, tell me about the war." The hours would elongate into the shape of bared teeth in order to answer, "The war has jagged edges, and it is eating us alive." The sky was helpless to resist responding to Mariana, who possessed eyes the color of leaves just thrust out from a bough, that green, the intensification of green, that enraptures anyone who sees it. Her limbs were thin and a sapling brown. Her hair was long and dark, and she twisted it around her fist if any locks got in her way. She had pronounced biceps and thighs and a wide forehead and wide cheekbones and wide-set lips, geranium red, which made her a child of unusual definition. One afternoon, when she discovered some boys teasing her little brother, Baltazar, because she and her family supported the fight for freedom, she grabbed a lute that her parents kept in the parlor and raced out to attack the boys. That's the first page.
This is at a time when the Portuguese are fighting against Spain for independence.
Yes.
And as an ally, they reach out to the French.
Yes, although it was in a situation where Spain and Portugal would go back and forth about territory and who was ruling whom. And for, I think it was about 60 years that Portugal had been under the rule of Spain. And they used the fight between France and Spain as an excuse to declare their independence. However, they really weren't strong enough to do it on their own or to fight Spain. So they had to take the help of the French, knowing full well that the French were not exactly being friendly. They wanted to annex Portugal at some point. And to the French, it was better to keep a weak, independent Portugal than to have a strong, united Spain below them. Hmm. But the Portuguese were not really in a position to refuse that kind of, you might say, qualified help.
Yeah. Of course, later on, the French, when Napoleon came around,
exactly.
The French actually did do
exactly.
that. And then the Portuguese ended up, at that point, allying with the British against the French.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there's still damage. If you travel on Portugal, there's still damage you can see from the years of Napoleon. You know, there were statues ruined and, you know, so history is long in that part of the world, certainly. I mean, it was hundreds of years later that prophecy came to pass.
Is that, do you think, form an important context for the story or important background to the story, the fact that there is this battle going on around the issue of Portuguese independence in the background?
For me as a novelist, it was important because obviously dramatically it brought everything to a flashpoint. It made things extremely dangerous, but also just frankly, as a very useful metaphor for a woman who's independent. And what I loved about Mariana as a character is that she's an example of a woman who lived in one tiny place since the age of 12 into old age, in one tiny space, and yet she wrote something that the whole world could hear. It was like a cry of passion that the entire world really heard. I mean, there have been many, many editions of her love letters in, you know, something like 20 languages. So one woman's shriek in a small place really did meet the whole world. So independent, it works as a backdrop taken from me to that point of what independence really means.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And also, we're talking this morning with Catherine Vaz, Briggs Copeland Lecturer in Creative Writing at Harvard right at the moment. And she's also Associate Professor of English at University of California, Davis. You are still have that association with UC Davis.
I was about to say no. I've left there a number of years ago. I'm just at Harvard now. I've moved to the East Coast and left my associate professorship there completely and have a 5-year appointment now at Harvard.
Okay. Was that a big shock, moving from the one coast to the other?
Well, my brother used to live in Boston for 10 years, and when I visited him, his nickname for me was Brave Orchid because of the cold here. And I've adjusted. I really did not actually want to live in California and know only that my whole life. So I did take the leap out here and really quite love it. I'm still enjoying the fact that one can be in one state and then go to work in another, and it's 45 minutes on the train to Providence, Rhode Island. And I am enjoying even the change of seasons, I have to say. I'm making a home for myself here.
All right. Mariana, she goes into the convent when she's, I think, 11, 12, something like that.
Right.
And she takes her vows at 16, and then at the point where she meets the Frenchman, she's in her early 20s. And it's one of these moments that maybe some people would say this happened to them in life, but you almost want to say it's only one of those things that happens in novels where they see one another and that's it. It's all done. She doesn't even know his name, but is so so captured by him, so captivated that she just has to.
Well, it's a love at first sight bet, but also I found some evidence in the records to suggest that her younger sister was also put in the convent and died right before. So there might have been some sort of great feeling of loss and need already inflaming her. And the French were paraded through the square as a show of strength because, frankly, the Spanish just wouldn't leave. The Spanish had dug in. And so they were being paraded as a show of strength. And the nuns all came out on the balcony to watch. So it was one of those great leaps. The other thing is that a lot of people say, well, how did someone like that manage to sneak into the convent? And the convent was, shall we say, extremely porous. They had workmen in and out all the time. There was a prefect who was so outraged by what he saw as laxness and all these kind of rich girls just doing whatever they wanted that he wrote a letter of complete outrage to his superior that's in the records. So we know that, you know, arrangements were really kind of loose. But to me, there's a suggestion of the catching of the eye. And she was such a willful person and so direct that I had no trouble envisioning that perhaps it was like that. And really, I took as evidence that in one of her letters, that's what she says to him, that from the first moment I saw you, you possessed me and all the rest of that. Mm. So that's why I set that scene up in that way.
Well, as you get to know her to that point, you get to know exactly how willful and strong a character she is and how she throws herself in more than 100% into anything. So I guess it's not all that difficult to imagine that a young woman getting to the age of her early 20s would manage to pack all of the kind of desire that you would expect in someone of that age to
right.
have been bottled up all that time, because it is, once this affair starts, I can't think of anything that's not a cliche that would describe just how white hot it is and how it is that she just cannot get enough of him, and he doesn't quite know what to make of it.
Yeah, well, the poor fellow. I mean, it was really, but she was very, very smart. She was educated. She learned to read because she was in a convent. I mean, it was the one place women could really be educated and learn about music and learn about art. And what's interesting is that in her letter, she's smart enough to even know at the time that she's probably in love with love even more than she is with him. She even says, I know that I'm deceiving myself. She says that over and over. And she also says, it's my own nature that has seduced me. So it's one of those outpourings. What intrigued me about her, though, as a character, and this is just maybe from a writer's point of view, is not so much the affair, which is interesting, but knowing that she lived a very long life after that with her probably being quite aware that the great event of her life was already over. So how do you continue to live in confinement, knowing that perhaps your greatest glory is ended? And there was some, you know, a record to show that this nun who was such a scandal that the king issued these proclamations throughout Portugal to clamp down on the misbehavior in convents, she went on to run for abbess, which would be really just unheard of. And she lost, but the wonder really was that she got any votes of all, or really of the chutzpah, to even think that she should run for control of the convent. Mm. So in a way, I found that she probably transfigured a lot of that passion into other things, more workaday things, the things that are in the realm of an older woman. And to be honest with you, that intrigued me just as much as anything else. She survived the plague years. I mean, she seemed, she had the strength to be greatly in sorrow over this love ending, which I thought showed tremendous depth. I mean, she was someone who had the strength to love greatly because she had the strength to feel bad greatly.
Hmm. And she certainly did, as she, when she realized clearly that he was never coming back, she right. never stopped loving him, never really stopped thinking about him. And when she was confronted by the priest, who, and everyone knew what had happened, and who said mm-hmm. that she should admit that she had sinned and should ask forgiveness, she said, no, forget it, I'm not doing that, and imposed upon herself a punishment probably even more severe than the church would
right.
have.
Yeah, I sort of invented that, but there was, what's unusual is that she was the daughter of one of the biggest landholders and freedom fighters in the province. So there was some nervousness probably about imposing solitary confinement on her for 30 years, which was the prescribed punishment. They didn't do that to her. There's no record of it. So one has the feeling, though, I mean, this is my novelistic invention. We know that she probably wasn't, she didn't get the prescribed punishment probably because they were afraid of her family. And she was one of the aristocrats. I think also the fact that she was this girl who was used to getting things her ways, and the fact that you can't do that in love probably really threw her. So she probably took on this extra punishment. But the wonder is that they didn't punish her with the severity with which they might have done it to someone else because of who her father was.
Hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. And they're in Urbana on line number one.
Good morning. I'm thoroughly enjoying your presentation. Because
Thank
my
you.
Name because my name is Mary Ann, I'm interested in the name Mary Anna. Is there a story about why she would be named that?
Name that? Her spelling, of course, is lots of different ways. It's a very common Portuguese name simply because, as you might know, a lot of Latin names have Maria in it.
Oh, I see.
So she was probably Maria Anna.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I didn't know if it were a family name or if it were from literature or, you know, I thought there might be an interesting story.
Well, if she, in fact, existed, that's the name for her.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. And others who are listening who have questions, you'd like to join the conversation, the number 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we've sketched out some of the story. We talked about the fact that this, for you, part of your interest began with these letters, the letters that have been attributed, at least some people have attributed to this mm-hmm. Portuguese nun, that she wrote to the lover, that he, the story is that he actually circulated them, as people at that time in that class did.
It was the custom at that time,
it was
yes.
the custom, just to, you know, to demonstrate, I suppose, just how the fact that someone could display that degree of passion toward you, and they ended up being published and then caused a great sensation. You include the text of the letters in the book, and you suggested you might read one, and I think that
right.
also would give people an idea of, again, what the story, the character, what it is that we're talking about. So why don't you do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and also what she's made of. Mm-hmm. I did want to mention that the book is available. You know, I'm getting some a playback here. I can hear my own voice.
Well, if that's happening, I'm not sure there's much we
oh,
can
okay.
do about
well,
it
just,
on our
I'll have
end.
To listen to myself in stereo. It's available in the Illini Union Books store, as well as the Aliform Group website.
Okay.
But I'm happy to read to you the first letter.
Sure.
Okay. It's about 3 to 4 or 5 minutes to read it. So I'll read it slowly. And this is the first, what people think is the first letter that she wrote to him. Look, loving heart, how profoundly you have lacked any vision. Oh, ill-adventuring heart, your fervor was betrayed, and with your false hopes, I was seduced. A passion that once promised me such unfolding pleasures now bestows nothing but mortal despair. As cruel as that which causes it, the separation from my beloved. My sorrow looks with all its ingenuity upon his absence, and does not know how to give it a sad enough name. Am I to be forever prevented from beholding that gaze where I once drank in so much love, that taught me incomparable rapture, that was my everything, that all I had been awaiting to suffice me to the end of my days? Listen, my love. My eyes, alas, have lost the soul light that gave them life. They are enlivened now only by tears. No other task can be put to them but to have them endlessly weep. Ever since I realized that you were set upon a departure that I find so unbearable that surely I cannot long survive it. And yet the misfortunes you have wrought exert such a hold on me that I cling to them gladly. I anointed my life yours from the first moment I saw you, and I take pride in making such a sacrifice. 1,000 times a day I send out my sighs that search for you everywhere, but the only reply to my disquietude is a prudent warning voice, faithful to my sad fate and inhuman enough to forbid me the slightest delusion, as it admonishes me at every turn. Stop, unhappy Mariana, stop consuming yourself in vain, wishing for a lover you will never see again, who crossed the seas to flee from you and is now in France, surrounded by gaiety, who hardly recalls your anguish, a lover who finds new ecstasies without the least remembrance of the ones he shared with you. But no, I cannot bring myself to judge you so harshly. I am too intent upon absolving you. I refuse to believe that you have forgotten me. Am I not bereft enough without tormenting myself with untrue suspicions? Such fine pains you took to convince me of your affection and lavished upon me. Why should I wear myself away trying to dislodge that from my memory? So enchanted was I that I would be ungrateful if I did not still want you with the same abandon that my passion instilled in me when you first declared your love. How can such sweet moments turn so bitter? Must they defy their own nature and now serve merely to lacerate my heart? Alas, poor heart, your last letter forced it to yield to such a singular state. My chest was ready to crack open from the boundless leaping of a heart battling to free itself and take wing to your embrace. Seized with these collisions inside me, I spent 3 hours adrift from the world, prostrate and senseless. I barely strove to return to an existence that by rights I should lose for you, since I am forbidden to devote it to you. Finally, though much against my wish, I revived, having flattered myself that I was dying of love, and there was some comfort in not being shattered in every instance by your absence. But since that disturbance, various chronic ills have claimed me. But how shall I ever be free of them if I am never to see you again? These tremors I shall bear without argument, because they come from you. Therein lies the sum of it. Is this the payment due me for wanting you so extremely? No, no, I must quit this. I am resolved to cherish you past eternity and to have eyes for no one else. You too would not be amiss if you never noticed any other woman. Could any passion less fervent than mine content you? You might encounter beauty elsewhere, though there was a time when you told me that I was very beautiful. But you will never find anyone who loves you as vastly as I do, and the rest, all of it, is nothing. Do not fill your letters with apologies, nor fall back upon exhorting me to remember you. I am unable to forget you. Neither can I relinquish the hope that you might come to spend some time with me. Oh, my love, why not have it be for the rest of our lives? If I could leave this accursed cloister, believe me that I would not be standing watchful here in Portugal for the fulfillment of your promises. Without so much as a sideways glance, I would strike out and begin the march that would allow me to find you, embrace you, and love you always, everywhere. I am not so foolish as to imagine that this will ever truly come about. nor do I seek to nourish myself with wayward hopes, for these might grant me some relief, and it is solely to the heartbreak of my misfortune that I can dream of consecrating myself. I confess, however, that when my brother offered me the chance to write to you, I was surprised to feel some flutters of happiness, and for a while it has checked my agony. I beg of you, tell me what drove you to charm me as you did, knowing full well that you would soon forsake me. My God, what possessed you to enrapture me so fiercely, only to leave me wretched? Why not leave me alone in the peace of my cloister? What harm had I done you? Forgive me, I blame you for nothing, nor am I in any condition to think of vengeances. I blame everything on the rigors of destiny. It appears that in dividing us, destiny has already done the worst we had to fear, but it shall not follow from this that our hearts need be separated. Love, stronger than destiny, united them beyond all time. Look, if you feel for me some tenderness, write to me often. I am worthy of your taking some care to disclose to me how you are faring. Above all, I implore you, come see me. Farewell. I can scarcely force myself to let go of this paper, to allow it to fly to you and fall into your hands. Oh, my precious love, what I would give if such a bliss were mine. What insanity, as if I didn't fathom how impossible that is. Farewell. My spirit fails me. Farewell. Love me always, and I shall endure still more. That's the end of the first letter.
That's the end of the first letter. And that is Catherine Voss, and she's reading from her novel, Mariana, published by Aleform. And I guess I want to make sure, again, people understand that this particular letter that you were reading, you did not write this.
I did not write this. This is my translation from the Portuguese version I read, a 19th century Portuguese version. And I updated it into what I thought was more colloquial English.
Right.
So it's my translation, but it's the letter that is either written by Mariana or ascribed to her, however you want to put it in terms of authenticity.
I liked the book very much, I must say, and I think it's beautifully written. I guess I could imagine some people hearing that or perhaps reading the letters and reading the book and somehow feeling that they were just over the top. And I wonder, as a writer, whether there were times that you thought that you sort of thought that too, that confronted with this, and also although that inspires the character that you've created, I think it's perfectly consistent with the letters that have been attributed to her. But sometimes it does seem over the top,
well,
and I wonder
in,
how
in
you think about
how
that.
How we look at that kind of thing, you think, good heavens, Mariana, you know, calm down, and anyone would run from that kind of outpouring. But in a way, that's the point. I think she's quite well aware that he's not coming back. And it's just pure, unadulterated want and need over the top. The way people actually do feel it, but we filter through logic. We filter through what's sensible. And the reason she's such a great romantic icon is because, frankly, she really lets loose. Mm-hmm. And she's not afraid to go over the top. I think if I might suggest that there's something quite... The reason she's just an icon in Portugal is because they feel that it's just that quality of being very baroque and over the top and effusive and passionate that is kind of a purity they really like and really that admire. And the American sensibility is more to say, well, good heavens, you know, any man would run from that kind of thing. And that's also true. I mean, that's also quite true. But I think she knows that. But it's really her heart spilling out on the page. And that's why the letters were considered contraband, were considered very controversial, because she actually talks about body and spirit as if they're the same thing. And she's not she doesn't really care if she sounds sensible. As you heard, she changes her mind about three or four times with saying, oh, but I know that's silly. And then she says, I'll love you always. And it's this kind of very pure, raw. And we have to remember, she was 25 years old and had no experience whatsoever. But I also think she knew that this was it for her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess as a novelist, I thought, good for you, let loose.
Well, and I think I would also expect a lot of people reading it would be able to associate with the experience of the first love or the great love. Maybe one and the same, maybe different.
Yes, and it's also, you know, that French idea, the cri de coeur, the cry of the heart that is not filtered through what necessarily makes good, logical, social sense. So in some ways it was really kind of, I did hesitate because, you know, there was part of me as a, well, now 21st century woman who thought when she says, you know, do what you will to me and I'll endure more, there's a kind of feeling of, gee, I wish you weren't saying it quite like that. But I thought, no, that is what she's saying. But she's saying my heart can take whatever love gives it. And as long as I'm not dead, it can take still more. And, you know, when you travel around, say, Portugal or Spain, or probably was the reason the book probably did well in Italy, is there's this feeling of, you know, as long as I'm alive, give me more and more. I interviewed one of the great fadistas in Portugal named Amália Rodrigues, who died a couple of years ago. But she said that fado singing, by the way, is this kind of very soulful blues singing in Portugal. Hmm. And she actually mentioned Mariana and said that that cry of, as long as you haven't killed me, I will take on more and more sorrow and love because that's how strong I am. There's a feeling of associating this not with weakness or being insensible, but with strength. So I hope that translates well for the American consciousness as well. And a lot of women here have told me that there's kind of a guilty pleasure in reading these letters because we know we're not supposed to think in this kind of unbridled way because it doesn't make sense, but it's nice to hear somebody do that.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. I'm talking with Catherine Vaz. She's a writer. She's now at Harvard University. Mariana, the book we're talking about, is her second novel. She also has published a collection of short stories, Fado and Other Stories. And her first, you'll have to help me with the pronunciation of the...
Saudade.
And okay.
My Brazilian friends would say saudade. It's a very Portuguese word. It's spelled S-A-U-D-A-D-E. And it's one of those wonderful words, German has a lot of them too, of course, that, well, every language does, that takes about a paragraph to explain and then you're really not even supposed to explain it. Saudade is considered, it's the Portuguese word for a kind of longing that's so intense that all the things absent from your life, people, places, things, and history are so strong that there are years that it's a presence in your life. So it's really like the presence of the absence. Hmm. And it's considered a state of being. So it's sometimes it's called nostalgia or longing, and that's not quite it. It's that you feel an absence so much that it's like a comfort to you, which is now that I'm defining it, sounds like what Mariana had.
I was just saying there's a consistent theme going here.
Yeah. Right in there. Yeah, there's something very Portuguese about that idea. So the fact that her lover was absent became the greatest presence in her life. So there's a kind of outpouring of saudade that she has in her letters.
Hmm. In an interview that I came across, you were asked about the fact that you were raised as Catholic, and the interviewer asks you how it had influenced your writing, and you said that it had done so very deeply, and certainly that's something that you can see in this particular book. How in what way is that an important theme, do you think?
Well, I mean, the Jesuitical expression, "Give me a boy till he's seven and he's mine for life." Well, they had me till I was 17. So it's a little bit hard to get out of one's system. I have the usual sort of, I guess, lapsed Catholic confusion, but I always liked the stories of the saints. It always seemed to me really good stories about people doing incredible things. One of the nicest things about Mariana, one of my friends who's a nun, read it in the British edition, and she said, you know, I think you were in a cloister in another life because you really get how nuns live in a place. And I was very pleased by that. Part of it was just research. But frankly, part of it is being a writer. You have this kind of same, you know, you work in a small place writing these things and send them out in the world. So I identified with her as a writer as well as with as being a nun. A lot of it was based on research about that. But I think also, since I was raised Catholic, I just got some of the, you know, how your heart is supposed to work, how you long for miracles, all that kind of thing was part of my upbringing. So I'm sure it informed how I wrote about life in the convent.
Hmm. It is interesting that you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that this convent might be a little bit different than others in that it was the most wealthy in Portugal. It was a place where wealthy families would park their daughters and that there were not necessarily women all who had very serious vocation.
That's right.
It is interesting the way that you write about daily life in the convent, and it does in places sound perilously like a sorority house.
Oh, I think these were women in a sorority house with really great digs. Actually, they were like nice studio apartments more than they were, you know, little nun cells. And a lot of because of the war, there was a royal guard around the convent. So a lot of noble women whose husbands were either removed or at war took up residency in the convent as well. So there was this secular influence in this particular convent because of the war going on also. And these were, you know, so these were women who they got to leave when the war was over. But yeah, so it's like one big slumber party for all these very rich girls.
And she, Mariana, had also, she was there, had two sisters after her, in the story, after her mother dies, two sisters
That's
come
right.
in, and her littlest sister was only 3 years old and lived her life in the convent.
And went on to be one of the abbesses. The abbesses change rather frequently there. But this was a woman who lived 80 years in a convent, from the age of 3 to 83. So that also fascinated me, like how your vision of the world constricts. I really liked her as a character. Not much is known about her. So in a way, she bloomed as a character in my mind. But the fact that she was a scribe for a while in the convent, I found very interesting. And it seems quite possible because Mariana also worked in the scriptorium for a portion of her life, that she was, in fact, like a tutor to her baby sister, having lost the other one who died in the convent. This was the baby sister. And I just thought they probably had a very loving, almost mother-to-child kind of relationship that probably saw her through a lot. One of the things about reading through the lines of historical documents is that you do have characters who suddenly come to life. A visiting priest would always check the records to see the nuns were doing their job correctly. And apparently one of the records for Peregrina's work was for the priest to be absolutely astonished and said, "You write stories about women. You just don't give when they're born and when they die and where they're from, like, you know, all the other nuns do. You tell stories about these women. They're quite something." And the advice he gave was really rather strange. He said, "The only criticism I have for you is leave more white space between the entries." And so, I mean, it was an easy jump for me to make, saying the effusive Mariana, the effusive family, it's likely that she wrote stories about people and didn't want to stop and ran through the white space. And maybe Mariana had a hand in that. And certainly Peregrino did go on to be one of the abbesses.
We're getting down to the point we only have maybe a minute or two left. And I'm sorry, I wish we could keep going. There's just one thing that I also find interesting, and that is the kind of life after the affair that you imagined for the Frenchman, Noel, who apparently circulates the letters just to prove that some woman could be that passionate about him and ends up marrying a woman completely different and having
yes.
a marriage that might indeed be comforting, but seems one with a marked absence of passion.
Yes. I mean, at one point, a friend of him says, "Have you been happy?" And he says, "Well, as happy as most people are when they marry." And, of course, in his defense, I will say that he probably was quite taken with this woman and did have to go back to France. I mean, this was interesting. I had a relative of his contact me. She lives in Vermont now. Mm. And she said she thought I was quite kind to him in the book and that she really appreciated that because I view him as a sympathetic character who was swept up. And then he got put on a ship and sent away because they said, "Do you not know who her father is?" And they put him on a ship and sent him back to France. Well, I don't blame him also for passing the letters around. I know that sounds very callous, but it was the habit in the salons. That was their entertainment. And his biographers have said that he was kind of a big, slow-moving fellow who was a great leader on the battlefield, but no one thought of him as a great romantic figure. And I'm sure that it was with some personal satisfaction he passed them around, but he wasn't doing anything that other people were not doing as well, which is you share the love letters that you receive. But they were all tepid compared to these over-the-top, you know, heart pouring onto the page things. And no one dreamed that he had written them himself because they were just so effusive. Mm. So I do want to defend him as, you know, what could the poor guy do? And it was nice to get a letter from a distant niece in Vermont who said, you know, thanks. You made him rather a decent enough fellow.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop with that, too. I want to tell people again, if you want to read the book, Mariana is now out in paperback, published here in the United States by Aliform, by our guest, Catherine Vaz. Her last name is spelled V-A-Z. Someone wanted to know about Aliform, so I can tell you, if you have access to the Internet, you can go to their website, which is www.aliformgroup.com. That's all as one word. A-L-I-F-O-R-M-G-R-O-U-P, aliformgroup.com, and you can get the book from them. Her other novel is Sodad, and she also has the collection Fado and other stories. She's now teaching at Harvard. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. They did ask me to mention also it's in the Illini Union Bookstore.
Indeed.
And always nice to talk about Mariana, so thank you very much.
Very good. And also we would like to thank the folks at the Harvard University Press Office, specifically Evan Whitney, for setting up the connection with us, for us, with Catherine Vaz.